Welcome. A great episode with special guest Barry Friedman.
Welcome to the Chris Ruggiero podcast.
I was so happy to get Barry to join the show because he has had a pretty significant influence in a lot of things that I've done. He has a refreshing and inspiring take on getting things done and making things happen. He has experienced quite a remarkable life and obviously shows no signs of slowing down. He's constantly reinventing himself and creating new things, and my favorite thing about him is that everything that he does is to help and benefit other people. So thank you so much for listening. Let's get to it.
Hey, good. Well, my name is Barry Friedman. I'm 52 years old as of today, almost 2015 here. One half of the Raspini brothers is probably how most people would know me since 1982. Been working the corporate market as one half of a multi-award-winning juggling act and having a lot of fun, making a living doing stuff I love. Also an author of a newly best-selling book on Amazon, I Love Me More Than Sugar. I've been living a sugar-free lifestyle for almost 3 years. I met Chris because he's an entertainer, and I tend to know and love entertainers all over the world. So we'll let other stuff come up organically, but how's that?
Yeah, for sure. And we'll definitely touch on some of the other things, some programs and things that you have going on as we go through this. Hmm. And I wanted to, the first thing I wanted to kind of talk to you about, which one of the biggest things I've learned from you, and you actually posted something about it this morning on one of the Facebook groups that I'm in with you about, we won't go into too many details because people won't really understand it, but the idea was basically stories that we tell ourselves and how they can be very limiting to what we accomplish. And how eliminating those or changing those stories can really propel you up to something that you couldn't imagine.
Yeah.
I want to kind of get your ideas on that. How do you, so what in what you've accomplished, what kind of maybe struggles in stories that you grew up with, did you have to change to accomplish some of the, you know, great things that you've accomplished?
Sure. I'll give a bit of background on it. There's one place that every story that we believe who forms who we are is true, and that's the space between our ears. Outside of that, that story is not the same to any other person in the world. If it's hard, cold data, like I'm holding this bottle of water right here, that's about it. But when we use stories to limit our lives or expand our life, that's the choice we have to make. And I wish it was as easy as just turning off a story or changing a story. Unfortunately, it usually involves a whole lot of work, maybe with a coach, maybe with a therapist, maybe with some journaling, long travels. Like I know you like to do, Chris, is just getting out on the road and looking at other stories. Yeah. So I had a story growing up that I was born in a middle-class family in Los Angeles. That ended when my parents got divorced when I was about 7. And then the whole story changed to now you're living with your mom and there's hardly any money. And she had two other kids with another guy that your dad doesn't know about. And the story's compounded. So messages I took on about myself at that point in life tend to still be driving the ship as I get older, as I turned into a teenager, a 20-year-old. A story I took on at 15, I was at a summer camp and learned how to juggle. And at the end of the camp, it was probably one of the most crystallizing moments of my life because it was when I realized there was a reason I was put on this earth. I learned to juggle at that camp, and on the last day I did a show with two other guys. And the whole audience, the whole camp was laughing and clapping. And it was the first time in my life I really, really felt good. The story I took on about myself at that moment was, I can't stop doing this, no matter what. And here I am 37 years later, still doing it, enjoying it. Made a living at it all over the world, have 6 passports that are full of exotic and wonderful stamps, and live a nice life up in the foothills of the Sierra Mountains in California based on that. So I've learned over and over and over again that the stories we tell ourselves can either limit us or empower us. They do. It's not that they can, they do. So where do we want those stories to fall? How much power do we want to give them? And how much work do we want to put into changing them? And do we have the courage to identify them?
Yeah, kind of touching on that, another thing that you kind of pushed me towards and through things is, and I know it's a big thing for you, is not waiting for things to be perfect. And I think that's a big thing that, you know, it's something that I struggle with as well. We talked about this before, I think, last time. that sometimes I want things to be, you know, perfect, and I want things to be just my way, and that story or belief kind of limits me from putting something out there that might be good enough for everyone else, but I don't think it's good enough for me, so then it never gets out there. How do you kind of go through that of, I forget what your thing is, when something's 85% ready, it's ready, it's 100% ready. You said it in a better way, but something like that.
Yeah, interesting. I go back to this really nice writing teacher I had in San Francisco once. I took a writing class with a woman named Adair Lara, who wrote for the San Francisco Chronicle. And I loved reading her writing. And I took an 8-week class at her house, and we'd go over there. I was like, I can't believe I'm at Adair Lara's in a class. And it was a great story I took on about myself, that I auditioned with a piece and was good enough to get into this class, which was great. There were 10 of us sitting around her living room every evening. And I asked that question. I said, how do you know when a piece is ready? And she had a great line. She said, when it's good enough. And I was just like, wow, that's really a brilliant line. And perfectionism is a story. It's a story that keeps us safe. If you never put anything out, you're not open to critique. You're not open to badgering. And on the other side of the coin, you're not open to sharing your expertise with the world and being seen as an expert and building your network. It's funny. Perfectionism is elusive. I don't know if it ever really exists, you know, outside of the movie The Matrix. I just don't know if it really ever connected for an individual. But I know what perfectionism does do is keep us safe from taking risks. Just finishing this book, having this book online now, I dealt with perfectionism, and I dealt with not good enough. I dealt with it. I didn't have the education to write it. I dealt with it. I wasn't an authority in this topic. It's just cleaning up a whole lot of stories. And I will tell you, perfectionism has killed so many great ideas. And the stuff we see out in the world, none of it started out perfect. You know, flight didn't start out perfect, that's for sure. And you and I depend on airplanes a whole bunch.
Yeah. You said something in there. You weren't educated to be prepared to write this. Mm. What is something that has, and you have never gone to college, correct?
I think I did. I did 2 weeks when I was before I hooked up. I don't want to take that away. I did a semester in junior college when I was right out of high school, and then Dan and I, the other Espini brother, connected that summer and just headed on the road. And I had found what I wanted to do with this lifetime.
Gotcha. So I think a lot of people think that that's, you know, a necessity to, you know, go to college and, you know, have that. Maybe that's just something that's another thing that keeps it in their mind, that they have a backup plan or something. Someone, you being someone who, you know, didn't go through that, I guess, traditional path, what was the biggest thing that prepared you for becoming successful in what you do? If you know, I guess that's a weird way of wording it, but you know, I think a lot of people rely on college to prepare them for the world. You know, if you don't do that traditional thing, what was there a moment or an event or a series of events that kind of prepared you to step out and play, you know, with the big boys?
Yeah, I think a couple happened early in life when I was still 10 years old or so, when I realized how screwed up my family was. And I realized if I wanted to eat and have clothing, I had to kind of get it myself. So that was important. It was a big learning lesson that I had my own back. Another one, when I had first started performing, I had gone to New Orleans. I thought it would be great to go busk at Mardi Gras. You know, millions of people, it seemed like a great idea. I worked with a guy, little known fact, I worked with a guy right before Dan for like a year or two. We did some shows together, and we went there, and he was in a healthier family situation. He had food and clothing taken care of, and I really didn't. I was in New Orleans, and I realized, man, this is me taking care of myself. So he kind of wanted to drink and have hurricanes and get into the whole parade thing, which I dug, but really I was like, wow, there's so many people here, let's do shows. So it was an interesting parting of ways there, just seeing, yeah, I'm responsible if I'm going to get something. So I think a personal responsibility has always been such a huge piece of my life. And it's funny, man, college is great for some people. My wife has two MFAs. She has a undergrad degree. I've paid for most of them, and I love it. I've enjoy seeing someone who enjoys education get into that. Not going to college doesn't mean I never educated myself. I read constantly. I'm on webinars. I lead webinars. I guest on other people's shows. And I'm always looking to improve what I know. I never stop learning. But it's funny. I was looking through my nephew's college catalog. He just started UC Santa Cruz last year. And I was looking through that thing going, oh, my gosh. And it became really clear to me that we're still training people for 1975.
Right.
And that's sad. I think the new master's degree is an email list of 200,000 people.
Yeah, I was thinking about that recently because, you know, I went to college and my degree was in education. So I was set up to be prepared to be a high school teacher. Mm. And I kind of just abandoned it because of the same thing. I just couldn't see doing that and living, you know, it's like I wanted to influence and inspire, you know, kids. And I realized that I was doing that in a school. There was not the proper way to be doing it. So I kind of
created a
way to do it myself.
Do you perform in schools now? Do you do any school performing?
I don't really. Not in like high school. You know, I do colleges mostly.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, I haven't really done the younger kids at all too much. So.
Well, I bet you're in front of college kids inspiring them anyway. It's just a different take on the whole high school teacher. Occupation. Yeah, that's neat.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned about how you're constantly improving and, you know, constantly learning things. What do you do? And you've gone through different stages, of course, as we all do with, you know, performing and being a, you know, a public person. Yeah. How do you stay motivated and inspired to keep reinventing yourself and not being locked into one rut?
Yeah, it's funny. 32 years, Raspini Brothers have been in existence, and it's been such an incredible journey, Chris. So many golden moments of meeting luminaries and being at the bottom, street performing. You know, not street performing is the bottom, but as far as the financial scale, and then up to corporate dates in foreign countries with first class airfare to get to them for an after dinner show, which is pretty much a thrill. And after our sixth TED performance in Vancouver in March, I just decided it was time to consciously take a year away from doing that. So I'm 9 months into that right now and loving it. And you know what I do? I gravitate towards what scares the hell out of me. That's what I do. And it's funny. I flew off my mountain bike in 2009 and had this little pin. I'm showing Chris on Skype here on our connection. But this is a collarbone pin. I flew off my mountain bike and shattered my collarbone. Couldn't juggle for 6 months. And sitting in that bed, my wife was helping me. I said, yeah, what am I good at in this world? You know, if I can't ever move my hand again, I couldn't even. I went to this hand therapist and she was so excited one day because I grabbed a quarter out of a big bucket of beans. And I showed her a video of me juggling five torches in a show. And she said, I said, this is what I need to get back to, not being able to grab a quarter. And she understood my lack of excitement at finding the quarter. But you know, so I didn't know what I was going to do. And out of that journey, out of that 6 months where without being able to move my arm, I realized what I was good at was booking a juggling act for a lot of money. That brought me to the place of, wow, could I teach this? Slaying all those dragons that come up, you know, the whole word teach, be a leader, all that stuff. It's wonderful stories that we have in our head about we're in for it, we're not in for it. So, you know, if something scares me, I tend to want to do it. And that's where I sat that day and I created a course called GetMoreCorporateGigs.com. After a few years of running that, I was in a mastermind group that challenged me to do a higher end, more powerful, more expensive program. I created something called Showbiz Blueprint, ran that. Now I'm in a mastermind group of very big players. I'm certainly the smallest guy playing in that group. And they told me they would kick me out of the group if I didn't come out with a five-figure product. Something that sold for five figures. So I came up with that, and now I'm doing that. And that thing's having huge success. And that's individual coaching, private coaching for very select individuals who I feel like I could really help. What's next? I don't know, but I just keep looking for what scares the hell out of me. This book, I Love Me More Than Sugar, the idea of going on TV shows and talking about something without being a juggler, scary. And fun. So what I use to motivate me to the next thing is fear of being bored. That's kind of
a lot of it seems like everything that, you know, from the outside, everything that, you know, I see that you do works and is, you know, becomes very successful. You know, that's probably a tribute to your, you know, just motivation to get things done and kind of what we talked about before. But has there ever been anything that you just gave up on or abandoned because it wasn't working? Or do you just make it work?
Parenting. I recently dropped my child off at a bus station. And just, no. No. You know, that's nice. And it's funny. Social media gives us this this strange story that it could really implant in our brain. Social media kind of forces us to compare our cutting room floor to other people's highlight reel, right? I mean, that's a great expression that I read recently. So yeah, there's all kinds of things that don't work, and there's all kinds of struggles. This office that I'm in right now, I've spent thousands of hours in here developing stuff that takes, you know, that looks so good in a quick snapshot. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of days that are very hard, and I have some techniques I go back to. I get out of here, I really time my work. I live by a timer to really stay disciplined. Something specific, though, that really didn't work. I may be in the category of that second choice you offered, Chris. I'm pretty damn stubborn. I tend to just kind of go, wow, how do I retool this? How do I get this thing to work? I study so much, it kind of freaks people out. Like, I can spend hours studying metrics on a Facebook ad or really finding the best way. I test, I love testing. I'll put up 20 Facebook ads and take them to 20 different landing page at a time and just keep testing the results on those. There's a lot of me that just loves the study part. Maybe I just didn't get grabbed by anything that the college catalog offered when I looked into it, because I sure do love studying.
You just mentioned about how you stay on schedule with a timer and stuff. Could you share with us what a typical day looks like for you? Funny thing to say, but
yeah, it looks like getting up very early to work out. I'm usually doing something for my body at 6:15, and I try and be done by 7 or 7:15. So cross training class, running, long distance swimming, bike riding. Really anything. I just need to move in the mornings. And then I always have a 4T list. I call it my 4T list, top three things today. So there's always three things that I need to do that day. And I have it usually put together the night before. It might have something to do. I have these whiteboards behind me that you can't see, but I keep every project that I'm working on whiteboards. I have a project, and then I have current things that I'm working on that project, and then future. And my goal is to get things off the current and move the future ones over. So there's a lot of projects. I have a pretty good team in place that helps me with virtual assistant tasks that I don't want to be doing, administration stuff for some of my membership websites. And I use a program called Action Enforcer, which I love. And there's probably other things. I've had that one for so many years. It's probably outdated. It's probably like selling someone, you should use DOS. But, you know, it's just something where I can set up my day, what I want it to look like, and alarms go off after a certain amount of minutes. So I'll spend like 45 or 50 minutes in an hour working on something very intensely. I have programmed in a 10-minute break I'll go take, walk, throw a ball to my dog, just stretch. And then I usually work on something else. I try and get four or five of those good blocks in a day.
Now, I want to let you do a little bit of, again, for some of the people who maybe don't know a little bit of your past, I want to give you a little bragging moment. What are some of the highlights of your career? You know, you lived for a period, probably a pretty long period, more like the life of a celebrity than the typical juggler.
Yeah.
And you didn't talk too much about that, and I want to definitely give you that opportunity to talk about that.
We were an excellent partnership. My partner Dan Holzman was very focused on the creative side of our show, and I was very focused on, as you can probably tell from this talk, on the business side of the show. And a successful show business career really has both elements in place. I think that was very lucky. I think in 1982, we first came together, did a handful of Renaissance festivals for the first 4 or 5 years of our life. Got on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson for our first time in 1986, March 23rd. One of those dates you never forget in your life, first Tonight Show appearance. March 23rd, 86. I think the second Tonight Show with Johnny Carson was It was in July, but I don't know the date, and I don't remember the set that well. The first one's so big. And then we did the Tonight Show with Jay Leno after that and had repeats of our Tonight Shows. And that was great. That opened doors to a ton of opening acts. That was a very good niche of the performing market in the late 80s, early 90s, probably 86. Well, the day after our first Tonight Show, the guy who was our manager at the time got a call from Billy Crystal, Billy Crystal's people, to open for him. Yeah, and literally, Chris, I was wearing tights at a Renaissance Festival in Texas probably 4 months earlier. And for our first gig, we were in for our first big, big professional gig, we were in Atlantic City. Well, that was my first Tonight Show, which is stupid. The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson is, you know, when you're wearing tights a few months earlier, is not a great plan, but you kind of take things as they're dealt. And could I have said our act wasn't ready for that? Oh, my gosh. You know, I had to remind myself not to pass the hat at the end of the 8 minute spot. You know, it was just, we were so programmed. That was how our show worked. But, you know, yeah, I could have used perfectionism at that point to say we weren't ready. The funny thing is, I could have used perfectionism to say that wasn't ready. But instead, you know, just went for it and did these great tours over the course of 6 years with Billy Crystal. He introduced us to his good friend Robin Williams. We did all Robin's opening act concerts for 6 years, too. And so saddened this year to have lost him, man. What an amazing guy, out of the blue. You know, that led to opening acts for singers and other comedians and, you know, Patti LaBelle, Tom Jones, Paul Anka, Tony Bennett, Dean Martin, literally anyone who was touring, they had the Raspini Brothers opening for them. 1 month, I remember being in Vegas, we were 2 weeks at the Bally's with Roseanne, and then the next day we started at the Hilton with, it was 2 weeks with Tom Jones, and then 2 weeks with Roseanne Barr at the Hilton starting the next night. So our name was really big on two marquees in Vegas for like a few days there when they were overlapping. That was kind of cool. And that when that market died out, probably around 92, 93, maybe a little longer, we had kind of dovetailed in with the corporate market, which didn't exist that much. But the corporate market was, it still is. It's just a remarkable niche. You can be so unknown and make such an incredible living if you know how to speak to that market and meet the clients and network and connect, which is so much easier nowadays. In 92, man, it was all the phone and it was all, you know, referrals and sending emails out and hard press kits to people and all this stuff. Boy, now mastering LinkedIn and really using any network you have to expand your network, it's a whole different game working the corporate market now. So yeah, we became a favorite of a ton of great corporate event planners and went all over the world doing corporate events. Touring with Howie Mandel gave us all our Learjet time. He always toured in a Learjet and we got to go with him, which was just awesome because we flew after every show. We took off after the shows and Howie loved, they do this thing how they shot that movie, the Apollo 11, when the plane takes off at such a high vertical speed, vertical rate of climb that when they level out, everything in the plane is still floating. So we had gravity free time every flight. We got to do like backflips and fly through the plane. Howie was always, you know, Howie's a joker. He was always like, take off time, remove your seatbelts. You know, it was so great. So, you say celebrity life, there were some pretty good parts in there. And it started very early on. Just, I remember getting our first corporate date. Someone approached us at a Renaissance Festival and said, could you guys MC this conference for Thrifty Drug, which was a big chain in Los Angeles. And we were like, oh, yeah. And I didn't even know what MC meant. You know, it was just like a four-day conference to MC it. So we took the sad little bits we had, broke them into different small pieces, introduced some speakers, had some fun, but I got a paycheck that I'll never forget. I think it was $8,000, which, oh my gosh, for 4 days, that was unheard of in those days. Now, you know, a 1 hour show costs just about twice that, which is how the market's grown and how our ability to market to the right people has grown. It's been a good life, but it was set off early. And from the minute I tasted that corporate market, I didn't want to go back. I just had no interest in, I did what it took. I put that stick-to-itiveness that we talked about earlier.
Ever miss that previous world of the celebrity and, you know, the jets and stuff, but you were very happy to get away from that into the corporate world, sounds like.
Yeah, it died. It went away. I don't even think there are opening acts now in Vegas. And if they are, they certainly don't give them additional time. It comes off the headliner's time. But, you know, Vegas, Atlantic City, and touring, you know, Westbury Music Fair, you know, every theater in the world where Billy and Robin would go to, and Patti LaBelle, we did a lot of theaters with her. man, she was great. We were always basically the only two white people in the whole theater. And it was a great tension the second we ran out on stage. I craved. There was part of my brain and my cell structure that loved that first 30 seconds of every Patti LaBelle show. Just it took me to the edge. And our opening joke always killed. And then it was home free from there. And Patti LaBelle did a great thing. She would she did an amazing a cappella solo in the middle of every concert, and she would work our name into that solo somehow. I'll tell you, that's pretty damn goosebump inducing, being in the back of the theater and hear Patti LaBelle whooping something up off the top of her head about you.
So those are some like crazy stories that most people will never get to experience, things like that. And I love hearing things about that, like, you know, those really cool moments and things that happen from people. But I also like to hear some of the stories that people sometimes don't like to tell, you know, things that didn't work out and some of the struggles.
You're a great guy. Transparency is huge. I will tell you a story I've never told in my life. How's that? And this is ugly. This is, you know, this was a personal, this was a real personal journey to get over this. I was probably 23 years old. No, I think I was 24. I was turning 24 in a month. The first time I did the Tonight Show, I was, 23, should have been so excited. But when I was home watching that show, all I could look at was a hugely thinning head of hair. I mean, it was incredible, Chris. I was doing jokes, Johnny Carson's interacting with us, getting huge laughs, and all I could do was sit in that living room and watch. Oh my God, I'm losing my hair. It sucks. I have two brothers with great heads of hair for they should be on stage. they have head, and I thought, wow, all I was thinking about was why me? So soon after that, I started looking for options. I went to see the guy who cuts your scalp and grabs and does transplants and all this. And then I ended up going to this place in LA that helped all kinds of showbiz people with hair pieces, basically really high, expensive hair pieces. So I was spending $5,000, and I think I wore hair pieces on stage for, let's see, probably 80. No, I wasn't on Tonight Show with it. But, you know, it was just sometime around 87, 88, 89. I just couldn't take it anymore. My hair was falling out. I didn't like it. No one was bald in those days, man. Now I've been shaving my head for probably 15 years and just, you know, thank God it all came around. But I used to get on an airplane and be like, oh, my God, why am I the only guy on this plane? You know, it was just weird. Like, there was no one in show business. People would point to Telly Savalas or whatnot. So it was a big personal journey to go through that. You know, what do I do about my hair? My partner has such, so much hair. Dan, I would walk into his hotel room sometime. He was actually shaving back his hairline because it was coming down too low. And I was like, oh, it made me crazy. So, you know, that was a big struggle. That was something that I really had a hard time with. I came home from a show in Austin, Texas, though. It was 2000 that I came home. That was when I started shaving my head. And I just said to my wife, I said, I'm all done. And I think I had seven or eight of these $5,000 to $9,000 hair pieces, like just stuffed, you know, as a scud. I get new ones and I just couldn't take it anymore. And I just said, that's it. I put them, my brother put them all on eBay. I think he sold them all to a theater company for like $120 or something. It was perfect. It was just so funny. Great ending. But, you know, I struggled with that whole thing of identity and vanity, and it was really hard to be on TV at 23 and losing my hair and dealing with that. And then I didn't like that. I never felt authentic being on stage in those early days. It was when I started just really being myself, and I kind of came into a new level of performing. I really connected with audiences in a different way, and there were bald people on TV. Michael Jordan had made it cool. You know, a handful of people were out there with it. I was like, oh gosh, it was. So, yeah, that was a weird thing. I just never told that story. It's an interesting piece of inner struggle that I dealt with for a long time. It made me hate doing shows in a way. There was a part of me that hated having to go do that.
Right.
And I had to have my hair like just in my regular life when I wasn't out performing, I had to have my hair like long on the side so it would match up, you know, when I put this, you know, this piece on. I was like, oh, God, just so much freaking hassle. I didn't like it, so.
Now I have.
We can go deeper and uglier.
if you want, yeah, that's my favorite. I love the. I mean, we always hear the stories of the you know, the sold out theaters, and you know, everyone wants to talk about that. But it's
right.
It feels a little scripted when people talk about that, and it's always nicer when.
And it, yeah, and it is, no doubt about it. I mean, those are the easy stories that are easy to roll off. And just like our stories in our head, you know, the good ones are the ones easier to play, or the ones that keep us safe are the ones easier to play. What are the ones that put you on the edge? What are the ones that make you later go, what's next? You know, what are those stories? Yeah. I've held a marriage together for 27 years, man. That's no easy thing in this business. In California, even, you know, it's almost illegal in the state I live in to be married that long. So that's kind of fun. And I'll tell you another hard thing. You know, I would have loved to have had a kid younger in life, but it was funny. All that stuff I talked to you about, the childhood stuff for me, I had worked through so many stories about success, confidence, hair, you know, the stuff I told you just now, so many stories, but I had never worked through the piece of how could I ever be a dad that was different than, how could I ever raise a family that's different than the family I had? And I never addressed that. My wife and I were married 15 years before I finally just said, okay, I think I've done enough personal growth work. And at the time I was 40, you know, to have a kid at 40, it's wonderful. I wouldn't change it, but you know, would I love to be 40 with my 12-year-old right now? Yeah, that'd be kind of cool, you know, instead of being 52 with my 12-year-old. Although that damn dude keeps me young, I'll tell you that. Holy cow, I don't know. Keeps me going.
I saw the video you posted the other day, the little flip off the edge. I was like, man, that's crazy.
Oh man, it's nuts. Yeah. And then this last weekend, he got so into unicycle. You gotta be careful what you have hanging on your garage walls when you have a kid. He grew up looking at, you know, four or five unicycles hanging on the wall because I just loved unicycling. So at five, I got him a little tiny one with a 12-inch wheel and a handle on the back, and I just pushed him around like he was on a lawnmower. And then at seven, he started riding. At nine, we went to Wisconsin, and he won a USA championship for uphill mountain unicycling. And now he's learned juggling his whole life. So we did these really fun shows last weekend, and he gets up on the unicycle, and we have a little ramp, and he jumps over a kid from the audience. And yeah, it's just, man, so fun. I just, yeah, I don't know who I would have been as a young parent. So I think as an older parent, I'm giving a kid a pretty fun ride.
Yeah. And so speaking of, you know, kind of influencing younger people and stuff, there's people who listen to this show that are, you know, I have entertainers that listen, but I also am trying to get even more non-entertainer people, just, you know, everyday people who are, you know, interested in doing something.
Yeah.
What would you have for advice for either side of that, you know, young people or, you know, not young people who are, I always want to get some insight for you know, someone who wants to take their own path and create a life instead of just coasting down, you know, something. What would you say, you know, to somebody after, you know, you've lived so far kind of a crazy ride?
Yeah, it has been. What you say, I've heard someone summarize as if you don't decide where you want your life to go, someone else will. And that is very true. There's a marketers that work all day long to figure out how to tell you what to think about, what to buy, what's right, what you should have, how you should look. And my gosh, if you don't take some control of that at some point, earlier the better in your life, you'll be someone else on the end of someone else's marionette strings. There's no doubt about that. You know, for young people, man, it's so damn trite, but you know, if you can find something you love, find one person, just one person to nurture that for you. I did have, you know, in all the juggling growing up, my parents didn't like it. They thought it was a waste of time. My dad was an electrical engineer. I was on track to be an electrical engineer, certainly. It was the way I connected with him. One guy at camp taught me to juggle, and I knew I was never gonna look back. And at home, I had my grandfather, Grandpa Red, who I love, and I get emotional just thinking about him, but he was the one, every time I saw him, he says, what new tricks did you learn? What kind of shows have you done? Can I see some of, it's just always on me. So, man, I love that guy so much. I found, you know, one person that really, through his carefully selected words, were able to undo any other words that someone told me. It didn't matter. It became noise because I had this one person who really believed in me. So for the young, find a person in your life who believes in you. And for the old, be that person for somebody. Man, what a gift that is to find someone and inspire them. If you can get involved in something that's outside of your own life too, I don't care if you, you know, I don't care what it is. If you can volunteer for somewhere, I'm involved, heavily involved with an organization called Boys to Men International. It's an international mentoring weekend. We have a rite of passage adventure weekends for boys, and I've traveled around the country co-leading those weekends. Man, it's incredible to help kids have a little bit of emotional intelligence, the younger the better, to understand that feelings are okay, that they're actually powerful, more powerful than what happens up here in our old lizard brain. The lizard brain is driven by nothing changing. The lizard brain, our reptilian brain, that's the happiest if we die the same as we came in. Its whole job is to avoid scary situations. And the gut intelligence, which happens much lower down and is much older, man, that thing's wise. So if we can learn to acknowledge that, there's programs for that. Big Brothers, Big Sisters. Again, if you're a kid and you don't feel like you have that, get involved in that. And if you're an adult who has something to offer, get involved in that. I did a remarkable weekend in February 2008, put on by the Mankind Project. That's an international program. It's everywhere in the world. It's called the New Warrior Training Adventure. It's a 48-hour, very intense weekend for men, physical, emotional, mental, spiritual. Takes you to the edge of anything you could ever imagine. And I don't know, I think there's a lot of chances for personal growth, and there's a whole lot of chances for shiny objects to ever distract us from doing any of it.
So you have devoted a lot of your time, especially recently, to being that mentor to help people change. So we'll wrap this up and kind of leave it to you to push the different things. Now, is there another Showbiz Blueprint going to happen? Is that something that you
push forward? I'm going to do another one in the spring of 2015. Man, I think there's been 135 alumni from that, and Chris is one of them, which is awesome.
Yes, highly recommended. So yeah, wrap up with, so Showbiz Blueprint is your program for entertainers looking to play at the next level, be a little bit bigger, which I went through that program, and you have another online program for entertainers and, of course, non-entertainers, 30 days sugar-free, which is, you can talk about that for a second.
Sure. Yeah, just real quick, 30daysugarfree.com is a program for, and I'm pretty sure because I've interviewed thousands of people who have signed up for this thing, gone through it, or just gotten a free report, and I find out firsthand, this is, and I can say it definitively now, the only time in your life you may get far enough away from the sugar addiction to actually decide on a conscious level the relationship you want with sugar going forward, because we are put on a treadmill since birth. Two of the first three ingredients in most baby formulas is sugar, and it starts young. And the life after sugar addiction is pretty damn amazing on so many levels. So I started as a whim on leap day of 2002, and then decided on March 1st to do 30 days. And at the end of that, I said, I'm gonna do a year. And honestly, after about 20 days, I felt so different. I slept better. My head was clear. My skin was clear. My mind was clear. I'd lost weight. I sleeping like a baby. I realized I wasn't going back, but it's got a strong hold on us, that sugar stuff. So yeah, 30 days sugar free has some neat info.
I've also just wrapping up my 30 days.
Myself. I love that.
I've not been quite as diligent as I need to be, but it's been a huge improvement. I've had the cheating moments, but yeah, it's definitely not what, you know, it's been a big improvement, and I'm okay with that. I don't need to be as extreme as you, I think, in most of the things that I do in my life.
It's funny, and I don't encourage people to the 30 day sugar free has nothing to do with going forward. What I do encourage people to do, and I write extensively in the program about why, is to give yourself that gift of totally clean for 30 days, just so you can really reset. After that, man, some people go back dabbling, some people go back full bore, and a whole bunch of people kind of just say, wow, I'm free. And any reduction, anything you do, I think any consciousness about what we put in our mouth or in our ears or in our eyes, any of the seven holes that are in our face, the more consciousness we can have, what goes in, I think we grow very powerful with each decision we make about what goes in.
And finally, your book, which is on the same level. Where can we get your book or look into checking out your book?
Anywhere online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any of the online sellers. One day I have a dream of it being in every bookstore, but you know, as it started out, I did a push and got it to a number one place on Amazon through a great technique. And it's doing really well now. There's a paperback and a Kindle version available at Amazon. It's called I Love Me More Than Sugar. I Love Me More Than Sugar.
Cool.
It's got a very attractive cover.
Yes. I'm holding out for you to post that link for the signed copy of the paperback.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'll do that. It's funny. I just found out I'm not getting my copies till January 5th. I was supposed to get them. yeah. So it's funny. I think people already have the printed version. People who are smart and just ordered it on Amazon. I ordered 50 from the publisher, and apparently I have to wait. So I have not really even held.
Right.
And this is one more great story about perfectionism, not waiting. I've already done 20 TV shows as the author of this book, and I don't even have the book in my hand yet. So I hit the road, man. Once I started writing this book, I got on talking about it. I went on with a dummy book. It's done all the time in the publishing business. And my goal in that was to have 20 or 30 shows by the time I was holding the book so I can step up to Good Morning America and the Today Show, you know, with 20, 30 shows under my belt and a book instead of waiting until I had it. So, yeah, I don't wait. I look at barriers to entry and I just hurdle them like an Olympian.
Just hurdle them like an Olympian. That is amazing. I think everyone should burn that image into your mind. And when something that is an obstacle or something comes up that you want to be able to overcome, imagine just being able to jump right over it, plow through it like it's nothing. After talking with Barry, I always leave inspired and refreshed because of his positivity and his enthusiasm and passion for creating new things and, like I said, helping other people. So I hope that you got something from this. And if you did, make sure you share it with someone. I think there's a lot of valuable things in here for both entertainers and everyone else.
Thank you for listening to the Chris Ruggiero Podcast.